We're going to be in Genesis 4 today. So that is where we will be if you want to get there. The first 16 verses of Genesis 4, which records the first ever homicide in human history. So it's a happy Sunday. Brothers killing brothers. As you're turning there, I will say a couple of things by way of introduction. I chose this text because Genesis 4 has been on my mind a lot, really, kind of within the past year because of a novel I read last year. If you've never read East of Eden by John Steinbeck, it's phenomenal. It's one of the few books I've ever gotten to the end of and thought, I want to go back and read this again right now. It's kind of a retelling of the Cain and Abel story. And it kind of has a lot of elements from the first several chapters of Genesis in it. And it's just phenomenal. And it's, yeah, Steinbeck. So he's really good. So anyway, read East of Eden. So Genesis 4, I don't know if you knew this. Paul mentioned that I went to seminary. One of the things they taught me in seminary is that Genesis 4 comes right after Genesis 3. There you go. That's for free. We paid good tuition money for that, so write it down. Genesis 3, of course, deals with the fractured relationship between God and man. Yeah, that records the story of the fall. And then Genesis 4 records the story of when relationships between humans begin to fracture, right? So Genesis 3, God and man, their relationship is shattered. In Genesis 4, man and man, their relationship is shattered. And that's not just coincidence. There's a reason for that. One is a result of the other, right? If we are not properly related to God, we cannot be properly related to each other. So that's where we're going with Genesis 4. This is the first 16 verses, so I'm going to read through all of them, and then we'll go back through and sort of go through it a little bit at a time. So Genesis 4, first one. Adam lay with his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. But Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and on his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it." And now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where's your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you're under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops to you, for you will be a restless wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." But the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, he will suffer vengeance seven times over." Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. So, a little bit of fratricide for your Sunday morning. Welcome to church. So let's just go back and begin at the very beginning. The text starts off by saying, Adam lay with his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." So I want to kind of illustrate this on the board a little bit and kind of contrast and compare Cain and Abel. And we'll use red appropriately. So we start off with Cain. Cain is the firstborn. And let's see. The text says that so she named him Cain because with the help of the Lord brought forth a man. So there's a connection there in the Hebrew text that we don't really see in English that I'm going to illustrate for you because my wife has paid big money for me to learn fancy old languages. So I'm going to use them here in front of you so that we'll know that this has not been in vain. So she says, I'm going to call you Cain, which in Hebrew is Cain. She says, with the help of the Lord, Kaniti, I have brought forth a man. So you see kind of the connection there, right? Cain, I call you Cain because Kaniti, I brought forth a man. And this is what his name means, to bring forth. It's kind of interesting, too, if you sort of compare what Eve says to people like Hannah and Eve, when Hannah finds out that she's pregnant after having been barren for so long, she says, my soul glorifies the Lord. My soul exalts in the God of my salvation. And what's her name? Mary, the mother of Jesus, right? Whenever she finds out she's pregnant, she says something very similar, kind of echoes what Hannah says. My soul magnifies the Lord. My soul exalts in the God of my salvation. Whereas Eve says, look what I did. God kind of helped a little bit, but look what I did. I've brought forth a man. So, I don't know, maybe some foreshadowing there a little bit. So she says, I have brought forth Cain. And then verse 2 says that later she gave birth to his brother Abel. So we have Abel over here. He's the secondborn. The text doesn't tell us anything about his name, but in Hebrew it's pronounced like this, Hevel. And so there's nothing in the text, like I said, about that. But what's really fascinating to me is that we do see this word elsewhere in the Old Testament, specifically and notably in the book of Ecclesiastes. You know, Ecclesiastes starts off saying, meaningless, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. Some translations say, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, all of life is vanity. That word vanity, meaningless, has a more concrete meaning. It means something like mist or vapor or breath, something like that. That word is hevel. It's the same word here. So they name their kid breath. They name their kid puff, if you will. Which is, you know, yeah, they named him after the magic dragon, which I think is, you know, kind of appropriate, as it turns out that, you know, this guy who, you know, he's introduced in verse 2 and he doesn't survive through verse 8. His life is very, very much a vapor, very, very short. Verse 2 continues. So we've got the two sons, Cain and Abel. Cain has been brought forth. Abel is a breath. And it continues in verse 2 and tells us what they did for a living. Now, Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. So let's start with Abel because that's what the text says. What's Abel's job?
Shepherd.
He's a shepherd. And then what about Cain, what's his job? He's a farmer. Yeah, he worked the soil. And so these are, can I get grammatical with you for a moment? Yes, let's all get excited about grammar. So, Paul told you I'm a language teacher, and so whether you like it or not, we're going to talk about grammar today. And I've got the microphone, so I can do that. So in Hebrew, these are both participles. Anybody remember what a participle is? Yes, we all do. A participle is a verbal adjective. But anyway, in Hebrew, often the participial form can be used to express a person's occupation, kind of their job. And so, you know, a farmer is one who farms, a shepherd is one who shepherds. And that's important. This will really come into play later, this specifically, this, you know, talking about participles. So stick with me for a little bit. But really, we can say that your job is really, to a large extent, defines you, right? It describes you. Oftentimes, if you meet somebody, you know, you ask their name, and often one of the first things you ask them is, what do you do? And so oftentimes, you know, you think of somebody in terms of what they do, right? There's Paul, the salesman, Lucas, the, what do you do? Lucas, the preacher guy, Chelsea, the stay-at-home mom. And so you think about people in terms, and you define people, and you kind of define yourself by what you do. And that kind of becomes a large part of who you are. So keep that in mind, because that's going to come into play later with some of the grammar. Oh, yes, there's more grammar to come. So hang in there. Also, it's interesting to note that Cain works the ground, right? Cain is a farmer. What do we know about the ground from Genesis 3? It's cursed. So already Cain is somewhat, in some way, associated with a curse. Kind of some more subtle foreshadowing there. Let's move on. Verses 3 through 5 read as follows. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, but Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. So what I want to hear from you all is why? What's up with that? Before I came back and kind of started reading this text, I'd thought for a long time that, well, we just, you know, God accepted one and rejected the other, but we're not really sure why. But I think there are definitely indications in the text as to why God accepted Abel and his offering, but rejected Cain and his. But what do y'all think? What have you learned before? What have you observed from the text? What do you think? Why would God accept Abel and his offering, or reject Cain and his? Steve?
That's always puzzled me, and it seems a little unfair. So I don't know. But I look at it, and the only thing I can really come up with first off is that Cain brought an offering from the ground. Abel brought something a little more specific, the mm-hmm. first fruits. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Although we're not given to believe that there was any value in that, at least in the scripture so far. Mm-hmm. That we can tell, but right. that's a difference.
Okay.
That's value in that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I think you're onto something there. What else? Other observations? Yes.
Well, I had heard and learned in a Bible study that a lot of it came down to his heart, mm-hmm. where his offering came from. Mm-hmm. That a lot of times when we give offerings, a lot of times it's out of obligation. We don't even really think about it. It's not really from the heart. We just do it, or we do it begrudgingly. Mm-hmm. And then there's other times where we're very generous. We're just like, here, take it. Take what you've got. Mm-hmm. And that was the difference between
sure.
the two brothers.
Yeah. I think you're on something, James.
So you see in Genesis, first chapters, Adam and Eve sin was a plant offering. And then there's God's offering. It's a flesh offering. And these chapters, you got similar repeating of the pattern. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that has anything to do with
No, that's interesting. I've not come across that.
I think it's interesting, just, I mean, it's the translation, and the wording of Cain brought some.
Right.
So Cain brought some of the ground, where Abel brought the first mm-hmm. and the fattest. So I feel like just those, it's almost in what's not being said. To me, it's more descriptive of Cain's offering. He just brought some, so it's kind of like he was reached in and grabbed some, like whatever the designated amount was, and did it, where Abel put thought into giving the first and the best.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
I mean, I think that's what I always use to distinguish. Mm-hmm. Which goes back to what you see about the heart.
Mm-hmm.
It's the heart condition that shows.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you just don't trust vegetarians, right?
Exactly. That's what we're getting at here. Yeah. If you hear nothing else, know that vegetarianism is not scriptural. And anything else to add? I think you've all hit on a lot of things that it really does boil down to kind of a heart thing. There are things again in the grammar that bring attention to this, to the fact that. Yeah, Abel, sorry, we'll start with Cain, that Cain brought the fruits of the soil, which there's nothing wrong with that. That was There are some interpreters that say, well, Abel brought a blood sacrifice and Cain brought plants. There's nothing there. That's not really what the text is getting at. What's really getting at is that that Abel brought what was best. He brought the firstborn. He brought something that was with a lot of fat on it, something that would have been valuable to him to either eat himself or to sell and make money off of. But no, he brought what was best to the Lord. And I wouldn't like that with Cain. Cain, it just says that he brought something, and it doesn't get more specific than that. Cain's sin is tokenism, meaning that he just was doing it just because he felt like he had to, right? He's like, well, this is what you do. You make sacrifices. I mean, I'm the firstborn, so I'm going to be blessed anyway, so I'll just give whatever I can to God. Whatever I want to. It's not going to hurt me. And so, we already there kind of see the seeds being sown of Cain's heart. There's a biblical scholar named Bruce Waltke, and I have to tell the story about Waltke. For a long time, he taught Old Testament down at the seminary. He got his doctorate from Harvard. He studied under Frank Moore Cross, yeah, who studied at Hopkins under William Foxwell Albright. I don't even have to tell you who that is, right? He's the granddaddy of biblical archaeology, right? Yeah. Anyway, so Waltke, the story that people often tell about him, he's kind of the stereotypical absent-minded professor. He one time drove to Houston and then flew back. And he called his wife from left field and said, hey, come pick me up. And she said, what do you mean come pick you up? You drove. Anyway. I get a kick out of that. So what Waltke says about this, Waltke says, Cain first fails at the altar, and because he fails at the altar, he fails in the field. Because he fails in his theology, he will fail in his ethics. Because he fails in his theology, because he's not properly related to God, he's going to fail in his ethics when it comes down to how he interacts with his brother. And this, again, goes back to that connection between Genesis 3 and Genesis 4, that we, if we're not properly related to God, we're going to screw up because we cannot have proper relationships with other people. So again, Abel's sacrifice represents acceptable heartfelt worship, and Cain's represents unacceptable tokenism. I'm doing this because this is what you're supposed to do. Well, I guess it was just, yeah, somehow communicated to them. James has already mentioned, in Genesis 3, after they know that they're naked, they cover themselves with fig leaves, and then God covers them with animal skins. And so kind of what's going on maybe behind the scenes in that case is that maybe God has made a sacrifice, and, he's killed an animal to atone for their sins. Of course, this is being written by Moses, in the context of writing the entire Torah, the entire Pentateuch, where the sacrificial system has been fully revealed to them. But yeah, at the time, I guess they just knew it. God had revealed it to them in some way, and it had already, before the law had been fully communicated, had already at least communicated this aspect of it to them. So my question for us is, what kind of sacrifices are we bringing? I definitely have a tendency to do things out of obligation. When you do things that you're supposed to do, do you do them willingly? When it comes time to give, if you do that, do you just cut a check really quick, or punch in your credit card number online and just do it because you're supposed to? Or do we take the time and say, God, I'm giving to the church because I believe what you are doing through Grace Bible Church here and around the world. So please use this. Whenever you serve, if you volunteer in kids ministry, do you change diapers to the glory of God? Or do you just do it because it's something that you're supposed to do? And I'm preaching to myself as much as I am to any of you. I definitely have a tendency to just kind of go through the motions. But that's God wants more than that from us and more than that for us. He wants us to really believe in what we're doing. Yes, even if it is changing a poopy diaper. So that's kind of the inciting moments for what's going to come later. These brothers bring sacrifices. Cain and his sacrifice are rejected. Abel and his sacrifice are received. And the last part of verse 5 says that Cain was very angry and his face was downcast. And in verse 6, the Lord said to Cain, he kind of picks up the language that the text has just given us. Cain was very angry and his face was downcast. So the Lord said, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? Steve Miller last week and a few weeks before that did a couple of really great lessons on questions. And so we have several questions in this text, and here is a couple of them. Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? Why does God ask these questions? Is he looking for information? He's God, right? And he was there when the whole sacrifice thing happened. He was the one that accepted one but rejected the other. So why is God, what's behind this question? Why does God ask this or these questions? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. He asks these questions to provoke a change of heart, to allow the listener to confess his failure before it gets much further than that, which I think is, you know, it's pretty instructive to us as parents, right? As far as ways to deal with our kids. God could have, you know, started lecturing him. God could have ignored it. God could have gotten really angry about this, but before he begins giving advice, he asks questions. And again, this is to kind of give Cain an opportunity to examine himself, to check his heart before things get worse. verse 7 continues, if you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. This verse is just absolutely just devastating in so many ways. If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? Does anybody's Bible have anything other than will you not be accepted right there? Your face will be lifted. That's a lot closer to what the Hebrew has. And there's supposed to be a contrast there. Because in verse 5, it says that Cain's face fell. And so God is saying, look, if you do what's right, your face is going to be lifted up. You will not be upset. You won't be angry. You won't be frustrated by this if you do what is right. However, he says, if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. Crouching there is another participle. This is a word that there's a word that's cognate to it in Akkadian, which is what the ancient Babylonians spoke. But you all knew that already, of course. The participle in Hebrew is robates. The word in Akkadian is rabitsum, and it is a word for a demon. And so there's one commentator that I read who translates this, if you do not do what is right, sin is the demon at the door. I don't take my sin that seriously. I don't often think that sin is a demon that's right outside my door. I tend to have sins that I think, oh, that's kind of bad, sins that I kind of wink at. But I mean, if we took sins this seriously, I feel like we'd be very different people if we viewed sins as things that are wanting to pounce on us and that are just waiting for an opportunity. Chelsea and I watched this movie recently called The Quiet Place. Anybody else see this? We wanted to see it in the theater. We ended up getting it on Redbox. Basically, the tagline of the movie tells you the plots. If they hear you, they hunt you. The world has been invaded by these alien creatures that don't see, but they have a really heightened sense of hearing. And so if you make any sort of noise, they hunt you. And so there's Jim Halpert and his family that live pretty much in the basement of their house. Their goal is to be completely quiet. But, of course, this is a movie, so guess what happens? Somebody makes noise, Because if it was like 90 minutes of just them going, you would like walk out of that movie, right? So there's got to be some conflict. So they make noise at several points in this movie, and then they all get really quiet, and then sure enough, within a few seconds, you hear, you know, upstairs, you know, scratching around and stomping, and you hear these things. And you're sitting there, you know, one of the things that this movie does so brilliantly is uses silence and uses quietness so much. Because you're at home, like I'm at home watching this on the screen, but I'm just like, don't make any noise. At that point I was like, you can't even put the popcorn down because the popcorn's gonna make a noise if you put the popcorn down. Oh, yeah, yeah. 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 Yes, yeah. Yeah, you can have popcorn, but we're going to blend it up for you. So you can have a popcorn smoothie. You just get the sense that, you know, they are crouching at the door. They're just waiting for us to make a sound, to come and pounce on us. And that's how the text describes sin. Its desire is for you. Sin plays for keeps. First Peter tells us that, that Satan prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he can devour. Sin is not sin's not playing games. Sin plays for keeps. It desires to have you, but you must master it. I'm going to read this. There's a Puritan author named John Owen who wrote a book called The Mortification of Sin. And he bases that on a verse in Romans 8:13 that says, "If ye through the Spirit do mortify the deeds of the body, ye shall live." And so he writes a book about that, about the importance of mortifying, of killing sin. And I just want to read this because it's just spot on. He says that the choicest believers who are surely freed from the condemning power of sin ought yet to make it their business all their days to mortify the indwelling power of sin. So the apostle, he quotes from Colossians 3, "Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth," which is Colossians 3:5. "Whom speaks he to? Such as were risen with Christ, such as were dead with him, such as whose life Christ was and who should appear with him in glory." And he gives a couple of commands. Do you mortify? Do you make it your daily work? Be always at it whilst you live. Cease not a day from this work. Be killing sin, or it will be killing you. This is really, sin is a zero-sum game, right? You can't just sit back and think, well, I'm not going to fight against sin. It's not getting worse. But no, he says, be killing sin, or it will be killing you. Because sin, like I said, it's life or death. It's not something we should wink at. Sin plays for keeps. In verse 8, we get Cain's response, or rather his lack of response. "Now Cain said to his brother Abel, 'Let's go out to the field.' And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him." So again, you know, God asks Cain questions. He explains to him what's going to happen. And how does Cain respond? He says, "Brother, let's go out in the field." And while they're in the field, he kills him. So again, the first homicide in human history happens just four chapters into the Bible. Let's talk about Cain's motives. Why would Cain do this? What do y'all think? Jealousy? Yeah, jealousy over being rejected when baby brother was accepted.
Can I ask another question about, see what you think about this? He said after the sacrifice was presented, the offering was presented, would it be fair to say no sin had been committed at that point? Did he do anything wrong? I mean, because after that, the Lord says, if you do well, you'll be lifted. If you don't, sin is waiting. Mm-hmm. He didn't say there had been any sin committed at that point.
Right.
I don't want to go too far afield, but I'm wondering if there's any value in observing that, you know, his anger, you know, is what led to the sin to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Or is that reading too much into it?
Ask that again.
Had he committed sin at the point of offering the making the rejected offering?
Was his token offering a sin?
Was that a sin?
Oh, right.
Or was it just, we're not, God's not condemning him for that, but here is where the opportunity is for sin to come in.
Huh, that's...
I don't know.
That's an interesting point. I don't know. It's definitely, God is warning him about sin that might happen. I hadn't thought that maybe
already.
Cain had already committed sin. Right.
Sin.
Yeah.
Talks about it, if you do right.
Uh-huh.
Right, when I heard that, I said, it doesn't sound like he has done right yet.
Right.
So the offering wasn't coming from the right heart.
Right.
He hasn't done right yet. When you do right, he was downcast, so I don't think he's done right yet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's made an offering. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
The process is if you do wrong. So he offers both of those
options.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I could see it being interpreted as, Cain has sinned in how he has come in an unworthy way. And so God is saying, do right to avoid further sin.
I'm just trying to defend Cain for some strange
reason. I don't think you're defending. I see the connection with this, with the verse, be angry but do not sin.
Mm-hmm.
God questions him in his moment of anger, mm-hmm. and speaks to him in that moment of anger. Do not sin is crouching at your door.
Mm-hmm.
So I could definitely see it as he has not yet sinned.
Yeah.
But God knows where that anger.
Yeah, yeah. He's kind of towing the line of sin, and God is.
It's a warning.
Yeah.
It's grace.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
But I mean, if you stop and think about what is sin, sin is anything that separates us from the Lord. So, and I don't know what verse it is, but in the New Testament where it says that any man who even lessens his heart after another woman has committed a sin. Just because you don't do it doesn't mean that you're free of that. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that you have full communion in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I think that this, obviously, he's God. He knows Cain's heart. He also knows where this is about to lead if he's not careful. And as a parent, usually we know our kids pretty well. We know their personality, we know their bents. A lot of times we know their bents because they're like our bents. And I have one child whose bent is towards jealousy. And his bent is towards, well, why does he have that? And I don't have that. And I get that because we're both firstborns. I was the same way growing up. Why does he have that?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get that,
Mm-hmm.
So, this story really kind of hits home to me because I have parents that would say, be careful where this is going.
Yeah.
And I see myself doing that with my child.
Yeah.
I know what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about this.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I look at this as that sin had already been seated in his heart. And to me, you can tell that it's been seated and already put into growth, because even after the Lord has this little talk, watch what you're doing, be careful, what is the first thing he does straight after that talk? He turns around and says, hey, Abel, let's go to the garden.
Mm-hmm.
That talk meant nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
I wonder when your question's about motive, mm-hmm. I see his motive being taken away from God, the thing that God seems to, I think he's angry at God, and I see him killing Abel.
Mm-hmm.
To hurt God.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
Not you want the sacrifice.
The
response. Yeah. I see this. He was already angry because his face was downcast.
Yeah.
God speaks to him, and then I feel like that message is important. He's angry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
That's interesting. It's a good insight.
I was thinking a little bit about Cain's mindset, because he really is the firstborn ever. The scripture doesn't record anyone else. Adam and Eve weren't born.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there's a mentality of, I'm the one.
Yeah.
And the other thing, Eve's saying, I have a man child, probably relates to Genesis 3 saying serpent will, or, your offspring will crush the serpent's head.
Yeah.
So maybe she's seeing that as a immediate fulfillment versus what we see ultimately happens.
Yeah.
And so maybe Cain has this mindset of, I'm the one, because, obviously that what his mom said was recorded, so it was passed down.
Mm-hmm.
And God's rejecting of his offering was more of a slap in the face to him, you know, from mm-hmm. his perspective. Like, you know, God, I've been told my whole life I'm the one. You know, why did you first, you know, not accept my token offering?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's another kind of interpretation of this text, that when Eve says, I have, with the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man. There's another way to read the text. I have brought forth a man, the Lord. Because, yeah, she was thinking maybe, like Genesis 3, you know, that this is the seed of the woman that's going to crush the serpent's head. And so, yeah, if he's been taught that his whole life, he's like, well, I'm supposed to be the one who, like, banishes sin from the universe, but you accepted the sacrifice of my baby brother. So yeah, I think all these things, you know, jealousy is entitlement as the firstborn. Cain's struggle is our struggle, right? Yeah. The Sermon on the Mount is what you're referring to. That, you know, I've never committed murder, but I've had murderous thoughts, and so I'm just as guilty. I've never committed adultery, but I've lusted. And so yeah, Cain's, the struggles that he has are the struggles that we all have still to this day. We all, you know, bear the sin of Cain. Just want to say, everyone, is your hand up?
Oh, it's not. But okay. I was actually thinking earlier, I feel like I'm kind of defending the relationship. I feel like, he, you know, just like in God's mercy, he was with me, like, he may have been so entrenched in his sin that he really wasn't seeing it at the mm-hmm. time. I mean, yeah. And yeah. So I feel like God was kind of trying to open his ignorant chance.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and yeah, again, with the questions, it seems to be much more effective if you ask somebody, what are you doing, than just saying, you're doing wrong. It kind of, you know, shuts down the conversation. Let's move on. Verse 9 is where we are. So Cain is a murderer now. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? I don't know, he replied. Am I my brother's keeper? So in verse 9, we get another question. Where is your brother Abel? And again, he's not looking for information. It's not like God is like, all right, there's Adam and Eve. There's Cain. I swear there's another human. It's not like God lost his car keys or something, right? He knows exactly what happened. So why does he ask? Why does he ask this question? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Gives him one last chance to come clean. But does he come clean? He says no. He starts off with a lie. I don't know. You know. You know exactly where he is. Then he says, am I my brother's keeper? And he gets a defiance. And of course, at this point, I have what song in my head? Christian music fans from the 1990s?
Rich Mullins.
There we go. Brother's keeper. Look him up. He's on Spotify. Am I my brother's keeper? And so at this point, verse 10, the Lord asks a question that is not, I don't think, expect an answer. What have you done? This echoes Genesis 3, when he comes to Eve and he says, what is this that you have done after she's eaten? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you're under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth. And so this is his sentence. It's fascinating to point out that in Genesis 3, man is not cursed. God curses the serpents and the ground. But here, God actually curses curses Cain himself. The curse expands. All right, back to that participle grammatical stuff. He says that Cain is now a restless wanderer, right? Guess what type of... guess what part of speech restless wanderer is? It's a participle. It's actually two participles. And so, you know, back here, you're a farmer, Cain. This is how people are going to relate to you. They're going to ask you for, you know, farming advice. When should I plant my tomatoes? Is this a good year for corn? Whatever. That's how people are going to think of you. But now they're going to think of you as a restless wanderer, as a homeless wanderer. One translation says as a wandering vagrant. And so that's who Cain is now, right? His definition, whenever people think of Cain, they're going to think this guy's a murderer. He can't be trusted. You know, sin changes who we are, right, down to the very very definition of what makes us us. Sin can do that. So Cain responds in verse 13, my punishment is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me. Interesting that the murderer fears murder, right? He says, whoever finds me will kill me. It's like, no, Cain, you're the murderer here, all right? Nobody else has done this yet, but you know, it's just kind of the sin in him thinks, well, this is gonna happen to me. But the Lord, in verse 15, said to him, not so. If anyone kills Cain, he will suffer vengeance seven times over. Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So even in punishment, there's grace, right? I mean, if you look ahead to Leviticus 10, Aaron has two sons, Nadab and Abihu, who bring unauthorized fire. They bring an unauthorized offering to the Lord, and they get zapped. They're crispy critters. So it could be a lot worse for Cain, right? This bringing an unauthorized sacrifice, at least you know, in one text, gets the death penalty. But Cain gets to go on living, and he bears a mark that saves him from being killed. So even though God judges him, even though you know God has rejected his offering and put a curse on him, even he's still merciful to him. Thank God for that. And so he's forced to live the rest of his life in the land of Nod, which is another word that means wandering. So that's the story of Cain and Abel. So God wants from us several things. He wants from us sacrifices that are worthy of him. He wants us to offer our bodies, Romans 12 says, as living sacrifices. And of course, the problem with the living sacrifice is that it keeps wanting to crawl off the altar, right? So it's a daily commitment to follow God and to live our lives as sacrifices before him. He wants us to care for one another, to in fact be our brother's keepers. And he wants us to struggle with our sin, right? It's not a question of if we're going to sin or if we're going to struggle with sin. It's a question of how we do it. And it's our task that, you know, by the spirits that we struggle well, that we put to death the sins of the flesh. One more thing that I want to talk about. I want to bring this back to Chelsea's been listening to a lot of Tim Keller lately. And one of the things she told me that he does a lot in his sermons is he always brings it back to Christ. How do we see Christ in this text? So if there is one thing that you know about me, it's that I'm a man of conviction. Lisa, I'm glad you're here for this. one of my most firmly held convictions is that Christmas music is only properly played between the day after Thanksgiving and Christmas Day. Okay.
Amen.
That's the gospel truth. You know, like KLTY, it gets earlier and earlier every year. It's like Labor Day this year. I'm pretty sure they're going to start playing Christmas music, which is a shame because there is so much great. There have been so many great Christmas hymns written, including one written by Isaac Watts called "Joy to the World." What? All right, Lisa's going to come up and sing the third verse of "Joy to the World" for us. Yeah. And so this verse really echoes Genesis 3 and 4. I think it is the third verse. He says, no more let sins and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. He comes to make his blessings flow far as the curse is found. And that's the promise that we have in Christ, right? That not just at a future date, but even now, the blessings of Christ in our lives are so real that even though we are cursed and though we're living under the curse of sin, he comes to make his blessings flow as far as the curse is found. And we live that right now. We experience that. And we look forward to the day when that is a reality all over all of creation. When Christ returns and puts all things to rights and the curse will be no more. So thank God for that.